Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Emergency and Critical Care Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, specialist of the American and European College of Veterinary Emergency and based at the Intensive Care Department at the University of Utrecht, Dr. Chiara Faltalina. Thank you, Chiara. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emma, for the introduction, and welcome to everyone. It's a pleasure for me to be here. And first of all, I would like to thank CPD Solution for inviting me to the webinar in emerging critical care to talk about pain management in emerging critical ill patients. So we people that work in emergency and in critical care are used to deal with patients that come seen in different severity of clinical situation, especially the emergency patient can present in a very bad shape. And a lot of time we are busy, we learn, and we are busy trying to evaluate with the triage again what the respiratory system, cardiovascular system, and neurological system are doing so that we can start our stabilization for the patient. But a lot of time we are so busy trying to deal with this very important major body system that we often forget that those animals that come through the door in an emergency, again, the situation, they are often suffering from different degree of pain. So I want to start my presentation with a couple of cases. Jenny is a dog, female castrated Jack Russell Terrier, 3 years old, and she was hit by car 20 minutes before presentation to the hospital where I was working. And as you can already see from this slide, from the picture on the slide, Jenny presented in a very bad clinical status. And it's very clear for everyone probably that are watching to see that besides the cardiovascular and the general collapse, she also had a severe, again, fracture of her left hind leg. So Jenny's initial presentation showed that she had a heart rate of 180, she had a very weak peripheral pulse, pain mucous membrane, capillary refill time was prolonged, which again were all signs of quite severe cardiovascular, probably hypovolemic shock. Respiratory rate was increased, and on auscultation of her lungs, there was decreased pulmonary sounds dorsally, which at that time obviously meant that she had a pneumothorax and she had a fracture of the left femur. So as I said before, we were really busy initially stabilizing Jenny. Oxygen, we bolus her with crystalloid infusion, followed by bolus of color to stabilize the cardiovascular state. Thoracocentesis to, again, solve the pneumothorax. We used the ultrasound to evaluate quickly via an AFAST if there was any free fluid in the abdomen, and we did some blood for the emergency database. But in all of this, I mean, is Jenny pain, did we think that probably in the initial phase of her stabilization she actually required very good analgesia? Another patient that maybe might not seem so clear in pain as Jenny might be is Elmo. Now, Elmo is a cat of 2 years old, castrated European Shorthair, that was found collapsed by the owner under the bed when they came home. Now, the history is a bit suggestive, and Elmo had a recurrent episode of dysuria in the last days, but the owner didn't actually say much about it. Now, the word Elmo presented again in shock, a heart rate of 100 beats per minute, where we know in cats, bradycardia usually means it is in shock, weak peripheral pulse, pale oral mucosa, and severe hypothermia. And in the video on top, you can actually see this is how Elmo was. You can see the position that he was actually assuming when we put him in a cage. On abdominal palpation, he had a large and very turgid bladder, and on emergency database, what was quite evident to see is that he had a potassium of above 7. So again, Elmo for sure had a urethra obstruction that was causing severe azotemia and severe hyperkalemia, which are obviously life-threatening. So our initial stabilization included, again, oxygen therapy, pulse of the tonic crystalloid fluid, slow warming up of the animal, and then normalization of the potassium, again, the plasma potassium. And later on, when the cat was more stable, obviously we had to give a sedation of just a slight anesthesia to unblock the urethra. And again, in all of this, do we think that Elmo was in pain? Did we think about giving an analgesia? So these were just two cases to show you that lots of time these cases come through the door, and again, we are really busy doing a lot of things for this patient, but sometimes it slips our mind thinking that pain is also an important component of their clinical situation, so that we have to do something about it very quickly. So actually about analgesia, the pain in emergent critical ill patients, there's been quite a lot published in quite some years ago. And I reported a couple of articles that are a bit dated, almost 10 years, more than 10 years ago, but are still nice to read. And what those articles actually show is that almost more than half of the dogs and cats that would present as an emergency to an emergency clinic or again a private practice, they were showing signs of pain that maybe they were not so easily recognizable, but they were in pain. And when we were talking about pain in these patients, usually we talk about acute pain. And again, acute pain, usually we mean pain that has less than 24 hours duration. They were all scored to be in moderate to severe pain, and inflammation associated obviously to the underlying disease process that led the owner to bring again the animal to the clinic was the most common mechanism for pain in those patients. So pain in emergency and critical ill patient, we're mainly talking about acute pain. Chronic pain in an emergency situation, it's maybe not extremely important initially, but acute pain surely is. And if we think about the emergency patient that we normally see or they normally would walk through the door, there are a lot of situations that are painful. Imagine trauma, multi-trauma like Jenny, thrombosis, organ distension, for example, a patient with gastric dilation and volvulus, ischemia of an organ, inflammatory response syndrome, immobility. And also we don't have to forget that a lot of diagnostics and therapeutic procedures that we will have to do to help those patients through the initial moments, like placing an IV catheter, perform a thoracocentesis, think about Jenny, perform an abdominal centesis or a cystocentesis, placing of a urinary catheter, restrain and collect blood via venipuncture, a whole quite painful procedure. We're used to perform them, and we know they're painful, but because for us maybe it's more of a routine procedure, we don't really think every time how painful these procedures actually are. So before we discuss a little bit again how to recognize pain in those patients and what can we use to treat it, we can say, okay, now what is pain? And pain, if we talk from a more physiological point of view, we can say that it's a series of electrochemical processes that usually starts at the site of injury that results at the end in the perception of pain. So at the site of injury, we feel pain, then the signal is transduced through, again, most of the time, the spinal cord, where there is an initial modulation of the impulse, and then the impulses again reach the cerebral cortex, where the again impulse gets elaborated, modulated, and the pain is perceived. If we don't talk in a physiological way, we can actually say that pain can be described as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience, which is usually associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or describing such a damage. And I like this phrase because actually what also brings when we talk about pain is the emotional experience. Now, we know with people, but it's absolutely the same in animal. When we talk about pain, pain is not just a simple transmission of signal that occurs, again, via the peripheral nerves, etc., etc. But pain is a multidimensional experience. It's a sensory experience. It's an emotional experience. And actually, what is also very important is a very subjective experience. We see with people, I mean, some people that they have to go through some diagnostic procedure would experience quite severe pain, while others would maybe tolerate pain better than others. So the same is actually for animals. And we have, and this is a very important concept that we need to remember, that again, because pain is unique to each individual, we cannot think that we will treat pain in every animal that would walk through the door at the same manner. Every animal will require a, let's say, adjusted to its own requirement, pain analgesia. The other question is that, is there any reason not to treat pain? Well, I think in the past, a lot of people, they were saying that pain should not be treated in an emergency situation. And here I just put a couple of videos of a classic gastric dilation volvus patient. And again, in the past, people were saying, no, we should not give analgesia in the admission of a patient with an emergency because it might definitely mask signs, physiological signs of deterioration. And some people would say not, because obviously it could give side effects. Now, if you see, for example, this patient, we say gastric dilation volvus, big dilation, obviously, of the stomach. The organ probably is becoming ischemic. Obviously, the dog is in shock. And obviously, as we can see from the ECG, has a pulse of almost 200. But it's important, actually, to treat pain in this patient also in the initial phase, because if I remove the pain component in this patient, it will allow me to be able to judge in a better and objective way if that tachycardia is related mainly to shock and not to shock and pain. So actually, again, the reason not to treat pain, actually, they don't exist. We have to treat pain, and we have really a moral, ethical, let's say, a duty to treat pain in our animals as veterinarians. So obviously, is there any good reason to treat pain? We already sort of discussed it. We also don't have to forget that pain itself, it will induce a stress response. And stress response means that a lot of counter-regulatory hormones, stress hormones, will be released. Catecholamine, cortisol, glucagon. And all this stress response will induce in the patient a severe catabolic state, meaning the patient will develop hyperglycemia, lipolysis, it will increase protein catabolism, which will then lead to weight loss. Also, at the level of the renal, the stress response and the liberation of the stress hormones will cause renal retentions of water and sodium and increased potassium excretion, which we really don't want in our, again, emergency patient. From a bit practical point of view, an animal, and I'm sure that you have all seen that, an animal that is painful, it will definitely don't want to eat. So reduce appetite, reduce food intake, which we know for a cat, it's a big issue, because if they don't eat, they will develop hepatic lipidosis. We know that actually pain decreases the immune function of the patient, which again will mean that it will decrease the ability of this patient to fight, again, any possible inflammation are present. The wound healing would be decreased. And also what we see in our patient is that when they are painful, actually they don't sleep. And again, reduced sleep will furthermore decrease, again, the immune function and the ability of this patient to, again, heal and to recover from their injury. Another important reason why we should treat pain is that an animal that is painful will tend not to move. And I'm sure that you have all seen those patients that are painful, they are in a cage, and you look at them, you pass an hour after, and they're in the same identical position. They don't want to move because moving often means painful in the painful area. But if they don't move, if they're unable to walk or to go outside, then means that they often don't again urinate, so they will have urinary retention, fecal retention. And if an animal obviously doesn't move and keeps on lying on a side, then it also means that the lungs that obviously is on the side where the animal is lying on will undergo atelectasia, which will decrease also the respiratory function of the patient. So I think you are all convinced, as I am, that we have enough and very important reason why pain actually should be treated immediately in our patient. Now, the question, the big question in animals is, like in people, is, okay, we have assessed the pain should be treated immediately, perfect. How can I judge if an animal is in pain? So how do I know if it hurts? Now, in people, you would think that it would be so easy. I mean, someone could come to me and say, Chiara, are you painful? Yes. And can you score again from, for example, 0 to 10 how painful you are? So a person can definitely say, okay, I think I'm painful 10 or 8. But despite that, they have a lot of problem in human medicine to actually really evaluate pain. So it's not so easy as it seems. So in animal, actually, pain is what we say it is. They cannot talk. So we have actually to take over the assessment and saying that they are in pain for an animal. And yeah, this little picture, I quite like it. There is a little answer that says, oh my God, yeah, because it is a really difficult task to actually be able to evaluate an animal. Again, think objectively if it's painful and then trying to do something for it. But luckily we have some instrument that we can use again to evaluate if an animal is in pain or not. And when we talk about critical ill and emergency patient, we also have to remember that pain assessment in this specific group of patients is also much, much more difficult. And why is that? Because don't forget that those patients also often are sedated, are mentally depressed because of, again, their underlying disease. So their underlying illness actually limits the ability that they have to respond to pain in a normal way. I mean, if you put a puppy and you give him a vaccination or do something, they often start screaming, they often start moving, they try to bite you, or a normal dog. But often those patients will not react in the same way as a normal, again, healthy patient would. They often don't show this dramatic behavior. They often show signs of pain which are not easily recognizable just by looking at it. And as I said, often the sedation, either pharmacological or just mental depression, often impairs pain evaluation in this patient. So again, just this to make it a little bit more difficult for us to evaluate in this population of patients if they are not in pain. So I wanted to show you again this video. This was a dog that was bitten at a thoracic and abdominal trauma, and this is the way it was lying in his cage. Now you can see the bruising, you can see obviously the surgical wound, but if you look at the dog, at the moment you say, okay, he's lying quietly in his cage, so if I would just look at him in this way, I would probably think that he's comfortable. I mean, it doesn't show any signs of pain. So how can we assess actually pain in our patients? Now in the past, and some people still think that using, for example, physiological parameters like heart rate, respiratory rate, pupillary diameter, blood pressure or cortisol level might be a good way to assess if an animal is in pain or not. But as you can see, what I wrote on the slides is the possible, let's say, differential diagnosis for an increase in heart rate, for an abnormal respiratory rate. So as you can see, heart rate, respiratory rate, pupillary diameter, blood pressure, they can be influenced by so many other things. Hypovolemia, shock, stress, fear, that all these probably things are going on in that moment in our patient we want to assess. And this means that all these physiological parameters in our population of patients are not very objective and definitely not validated way to say if a patient is in pain or not. So for sure we can obviously look at the heart rate, for sure we can look at the pupillary diameter, etc., etc., but this should not be used as the only parameters that we have to say if an animal is suffering or not. So there are some, and I want to show you another video actually. This is another dog. Dog had a severe pancreatitis, and the dog is now lying in his cage. As you can see again, he's lying quietly, he's not doing very much. So again, just remember this, and because we're going to go now to some pain scoring system to see if our initial judgment of the dog is lying comfortably might again be correct. So what pain scoring system do we have available? There are different scales available, which are all, again, modification of human scale. And one is the visual analog scale, simple descriptive scale, or a multiparametric of composite scale. Now, the visual analog scale is the simplest scale that we have, and it's a bit the one that I showed you in the beginning with people with the little faces. Again, you just have a line, zero is no pain, 100 millimeters or whatever, it's the worst pain that you can, again, endure. So, yeah, if I would have to use this in the dog that I've just seen, I don't know, probably, you know, the dog's not doing anything, maybe the dog is not so painful. So you can already understand how this visual analog scale just evaluate one component of pain, and it doesn't allow you to properly judge if the animal is painful or not. Simple descriptive scale actually is obviously a step further than the one before, and what it does, it has some description of pain, and based on different description you can give again a scoring, no pain, mild pain, moderate pain, etc. One simple descriptive scale that we have available in dog is the Colorado State University or Canine Again Simple Descriptive Pain Scale. And as you can see, there are scoring from 0 to 4. And if you read what is gained, what it is said, there is a description on how the patient should present. And if you read the description, that description fits the description of your patient in that moment, then you can evaluate again if your patient is painful or not painful. So again, the canine sample descriptive pain scale is a good scale and definitely will help you to allow to score different important things for patients, but again, it's still a bit more simple. So in dogs, there are different pain scales that are available, and those are actually called composite scales. And there are different versions that are available. There is the University of Melbourne Pain Scale, Glasgow Composite Pain Scale, or the Colorado State Pain Scale Score Evaluation Form. The one that has been actually validated for the evaluation of acute pain in dogs is the Glasgow Composite Pain Scale. Now, the Glasgow Composite Pain Scale is, again, so far the only pain scale that has been validated for detection of acute pain in dogs. And it's very important. It tries to evaluate pain from different point of view. First of all, there are first observation of the patient, first of a distance, but then there is also an interaction with the patient. And it scores 7 categories: comfort of the patient, the vocalization of the patient, mobility, posture, attention to painful area, response to touch, and demeanor of the patient. And for each of these categories, there are some number of descriptive terms which have been affixed and validated. And based on the description of these terms, you're going to give them a scoring. And I put in the presentation, but this form, you can actually find it online. You can Google it online. This is quite useful, and it's what we are using also in our intensive care, is the short form of the Glasgow Composite Pain Scale. So as you can see, it's just an A4. It's a smaller form of this pain scoring. And you can just go through it and give a score to each of these, parts, and then at the end you will put them together. So the maximum pain score that you can have is 24 or 20 if you skip, for example, the mobility assessment. I mean, for patients that, for example, have pelvic fracture or severe fracture, spinal fracture, they cannot be obviously moved and assess if they can walk or not. At the end, you're going to get, obviously, an intervention level. So you're going to do your score, and there is an intervention level that is fixed, meaning that if your score is 6 over 24 or 5 over 20, then it means that your patient is painful and you have to do something to implement their, again, analgesic level. I would really suggest, if you're not using that, to start using this short form, the Glasgow Composite Pain Scale, in your patient, because it's a very simple scale to use. And maybe in the beginning, you will have to have the form under your hand and to have, for example, on another page, the description of the different terms, just to become acquainted with, again, what they mean. But after a while, if you're using it quite frequently, then you really probably don't need to have the scale per se, but you can just perform the pain scoring out of your mind, with your mind. I put it in here, even if the UNES Botecatu multidimensional composite pain scoring is mainly for cats. But I put it here just because, again, it's the only validated, again, multidimensional composite pain scale in cats. It's a bit more complicated than the Glasgow modified, again, pain scoring system. You can download again and you can actually see how it is performed. That's why I put it again, sort of a website where you can go. And It, as you can see, it validates 10 items, posture, comfort, activity, attitude, and other important parameters. As I say, it's just a bit more complicated. It's just a bit longer to perform than, for example, the short form of the Glasgow Composite Pain Scale. But again, we're going to discuss about CATS in a just brief moment. CATS are even more difficult to evaluate pain. So I would definitely suggest you, if you have a complicated case in a CAT where the simpler pain scoring maybe are not very helpful, then definitely this type of pain scoring system might be quite helpful for you to use. So this is the dog that I showed you before that we looked in the beginning and we thought that it was lying okay. Now, this obviously dog had already received quite some analgesia, but again, as soon as you look at the dog, you think it's lying quite comfortably, but as soon as we did an abdominal palpation, you can see that it's really trying to react. And you now you can see what I mean, that this is not the classic reaction that you would expect in normal patients. Yeah, it's not a dramatic reaction, but you see that it's really trying to, again, protect the abdomen. The abdomen was very painful, was very hard, and the dog was only doing that as, they say, the only pain signs that he was showing to us. So this is, again, to me, shows that it's very, very important in this situation that you not only look from a distance at the animal, but that you have a pain scoring in your hand and that you can use this pain scoring to evaluate pain in a multimodal way. As I said before, this is another video, it's the same dog that I showed you that was lying, again, sort of lying in his cage. This is what happened when we palpate his abdomen. He put himself in a prayer position. And this, you know, the prayer position in dogs is usually, we always say, which is quite true, it is usually a sign of severe abdominal pain. So again, if I would just pass by his cage and look at him lying there, I would think, oh, my analgesic plan is doing great. But as soon as I touched his abdomen, as soon as I touched his wounds, this is the reaction I got. So to me, this meant, okay, your analgesic plan is not working as well as you wanted to. You have to implement it, you have to do something about it. When we talk about CATS, CATS obviously they have a different way to show that they are comfortable. CATS, even if they are in a cage, okay, maybe the less stressed CATS that are hospitalized, they can stretch. Usually they arch their back, they groom themselves, they adopt normal posture to sleep, most of the time like the cat that I show you on the picture, is curled up in lateral recumbency. And this is a video of Elmo. And this is Elmo, the cat that I showed you in the beginning when he was in his cage. Again, look at the posture because I will show you some photos. If you look at him, it's not comfortable. Look what he's doing. He's trying to protect his abdomen. He's not looking at me that I'm in front of him. He's actually looking the floor, his eyes are almost closed, he's not moving, he's really trying not to move. And as soon as a colleague of mine touched his abdomen very gently, you could see the reaction. So this is, again, how cats would show signs of pain. And a few years ago now, quite interesting, Boehringer Ingelheim, and I'm sure that probably you have all seen already those, they came as a poster and they were distributed to the major veterinary in the clinics. They published this quite nice poster about faces of pain in cats. And as simple as it might sound, it is actually quite helpful and it actually really shows some posture the cat can assume when they're painful or when analgesia might be implemented. So, and I also like the name that they use, which makes also, let's say, remembering how they look a bit more easy. So let's say the comfortable cat is the classic croissant cat, which is again lying like the cat in this picture. It's quite comfortable. And if you're obviously having a cat on analgesia, if the cat is assuming this, this posture, then it means it is quite comfortable. Then you have the so-called V cat, and it's usually a cat. And again, if you think about the face of Elmo that I showed you in the video, you can imagine that the face very much looked the same. Had narrow eyes, they are staring again at the ground, hanging with the face. The ears are usually backward and a little bit twisted. And again, this is usually signs of moderate to severe pain. Then we have Quasimodo, and again, remember the video of Elmo that I showed you, it was absolutely the same posture. Again, very quiet, the back is arched, is in external position, the elbows are back. What he's doing in this moment, this cat, is just to try to protect the abdomen. What he wants to do is like, my abdomen is painful, I'm doing everything to, again, allow no one to touch my abdomen. So this is usually signs of moderate to severe abdominal pain. And then we have the so-called knockout cat, which is a cat that is lying, very rigid, almost unresponsive to surroundings, and usually a cat with moderate severe pain. It's a cat that would not move from that position. And then is my favorite, the Godzilla cat, which is usually a classic friendly cat that might suddenly become aggressive, usually if the painful area is touched. So again, a cat maybe you examine, you did something and then maybe went to surgery, or again, as you did some procedure and then afterwards you're not allowed to touch them anymore. It's not just that maybe the cat just became scared or they don't like you anymore. Pain can definitely be a component of a change behavior. For cats, as I said before, that so this sort of recognizing, facing a posture in cats might be quite helpful. Also, Colorado State has a descriptive scale in cats that works a little bit from the one in dogs. As you can see, there are from 0 to 4 with different description of how the animal presents, and you can again score your patient using this scale. Or, as I said before, in if you want to use it, I think obviously is the only one that's really been validated in cats, is the UNES Botecato pain scale that I showed you initially. And this is, at the moment it's not working very well. Okay, this is another video of a cat, obviously came back from surgery. You can see the one had a mastectomy, and you can recognize the so-called knockout cats. I mean, this was a cat that was put in a cage. Now you can say it's recovering from analgesia, but as you can see, she's not doing anything, she's not looking around. I'm going to go close to her. She was doing nothing. This in cats is really signs of severe pain. Again, I'm in front of her, she's not even looking at me. The only moment in which she tried to kill me is when I really gentle try to go just closer to the wound. I didn't even touch the wound. And that was for me already the posture of the cat, but just that for me was again a sign that she was just in extreme pain and something else needed to be done to her analgesia. So when we talk about pain management in our patient, obviously what we want to do is to provide optimal comfort, but obviously without worsening their clinical condition. So let's say the great analgesic would be the one that I could give without, again, that would work, obviously, and also would not cause any side effects to my patient. Yeah, obviously that doesn't exist. But obviously what I want also to have is to have at least an adequate control of pain, and also in some patients, adequate control of anxiety and stress. And we can divide our approach in a non-pharmacological approach and in one more, obviously, pharmacological approach. Now, non-pharmacological approach sounds very basic, but it's also quite important. Careful handling of patients. Imagine Elmo, imagine Jenny. They walk through your door, they're on your table. Jenny, multi-trauma, fracture of the femur, maybe emo abdomen, I don't know. If you handle her gently, you're going to decrease, obviously, the extra pain that she will probably feel. So remember to handle very gently, to restrain very gently your patient. When they're in a cage, make sure that they have a comfortable place to lie. Change their recumbency every 4 hours. Keep them dry, keep them clean. If the patient is not able to go outside, always take care of the bladder, which sometimes, actually majority of times, might mean that you have to place a urinary catheter. Bladder distension can be quite painful, and if a dog is not used to urinate where he's lying, some dogs might keep actually the urine for even a day. But imagine the pain that that patient might be suffering. And obviously, if an animal is in a cage and is lying and you are giving food or water, make sure that you're going to put them in a way that they can easily reach it and they don't have to, again, crawl through the cage to reach water or to reach food. For the people that works with me, they always laugh about me because I'm a big, big fan of Tender Loving Care, the TLC. But it really works. I mean, again, imagine that these are patients that, again, they are in a cage, they are traumatized, they are painful, they are stressed. You often approach them every 2 to 4 hours to check temperature, pulse, respiration. You take blood, you do things. Show that also you approach them just to pet them again, just to be with them, just to groom them. And obviously, if the patient allow it, cuddle them. A lot of time in people, we know in child, it often works, and it really works also on our animal, just to show them some compassion, empathy, and tender loving care. Obviously, that is not enough to treat pain, and that's where our pharmacological approach comes into again play. What do we have available? What can we use to treat pain in our patient? We have opioids drug, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, or non-NSAIDs, ketamine, lidocaine, alpha-2 agonist, and local analgesia. Now, as you can see already from these slides, I put opioids on top, and we're going to discuss in a short moment why I put opioids on top. Because opioids, I think, besides being the best drugs that we really have available, they actually are should be used as the base of analgesia in our patient. Now, all the other drugs, plus or minus, and we're going to see again, depending on the characteristic of the patient, they can all be combined together in a multimodal analgesia protocol, an analgesia approach. And actually, I have to say that I prefer often the multimodal analgesia protocol to the single, let's say, pharmacological approach, for the reason then in a multimodal analgesic protocol, what you do, you use actually different analgesica, the one that I just mentioned, with the idea that all of them, as you can see from this picture, they work on different steps of the nociception pathway. So by combining some of this drug together, first of all, it might allow you to decrease the dosage, and often decreasing the dosage of all the drugs that you're using might also mean decreasing the side effects. And also it will allow you to target different steps of the nociception pathway and increasing again the analgesia that you are giving to your patient. Plus, some of these drugs, when you combine them together, for example, a non-steroidal with an opioid, alpha-2 agonist, an opioid, they also have a synergic effect, so they actually increase the potency of the analgesic effect when you put them together. How can I administer my analgesia? There are different ways that I can use. Obviously, intravenous in our emergency and critical care patient is the route that I would prefer because obviously you know what you're giving, you know that it's going to get absorbed well, and obviously it is more titratable. It can be given as a bolus, an intermittent bolus, or as a constant rate infusion. Now, unfortunately, not every drug can be given a constant rate infusion, but definitely in, again, constant rate infusion, that would be my preferred way of administering an analgesic effect. And that is really to decrease the classic increase in the, again, plasmatic analgesic level and then sudden decrease when we come closer to the next administration. Constant rate infusion will allow you to keep constant, actually, the sort of analgesic plasmatic level of the drug without the trough and, again, the dip of the analgesia itself. But can be given, some analgesics can be also given intramuscularly, subcutaneously, some orally. You can use some analgesics as intrapleural block or, again, local analgesia. Opioids, as I said before, they're definitely the first choice in emergency and critical ill patients. And why are they my first choice? Because they really work very quickly, so they have a rapid onset of action. They have a quite good safety. They are very potent analgesics, so they work for moderate to severe pain, and for the majority of them, not all of them, we're going to discuss again, reversal is often possible. Now, opioids are often divided in different categories. We call them pure mu opioids. Again, drugs like morphine, methadone, fentanyl, sufentanyl, remifentanil, partial agonists like buprenorphine, or agonist antagonists like butorphanol. In this presentation, I will not talk about butorphanol, agonist antagonist. For one simple reason is that butorphanol is not a very strong analgesic, has quite a good sedative effect, and usually the sedative effect has a longer duration than the analgesic one. So probably butorphanol would not be the analgesic that I would suggest to use in emerging critically ill patients. Unless, for example, we have to do some procedure that are painful and might require a bit of sedation. So another thing that I want to get out of the way is the misconception of cats and opioid mania. You probably have heard, or some people have told you, that you cannot give or use opioid in cats is controversial because they can get a bit crazy. Well, this is not really true. This is was a kitten that just received opioid. This is usually what happens in cats with opioid. They become very, very, very happy. They become very cuddly. They become very happy. For sure, in some of them, maybe the effect can be a little bit too much. But again, I've rarely see the described opioids mania in cats. What is possible to see in cats, actually, as we're going to see from the next video, is that sometimes when maybe the opioids are a bit too much, is that you can have some dysphoria effect. So you see a cat that is a bit dysphoric, he doesn't know what he wants, he keeps on looking, is a bit agitated. I mean, this is often as bad as the side effect of an opioid goes in a cat. But again, don't be afraid of using opioids to really cause opioid dysphoria in cats. Often it also has to do with obviously individual sensitivity to opioids and also to the dose that you're using. But one of the important things that I want to say about cats is that while in dogs opioids often cause meiosis, in cats actually opioid administration can cause mydriasis. And look, this is the picture of one of my old cats actually. And the mydriasis is pretty big, which also means that cats that are received opioids are not very able to accommodate their pupil. So this means that if you approach them very quickly, they might not be able to see you coming, so they might get more agitated. They might get, again, a little bit more distressed. So if you're that given opioid to a cat, just approach them even a bit more gently and more quietly than you would normally do, because they might not be able to see you coming if you approach them very quickly. Remember also that pure mu opioid in cats might cause a degree of elevation in their body temperature. So usually we're talking about 1 degree, again, 1 degree elevation. So we're not talking about temperature of 38 becoming 41, but often maybe 38 becoming 39 point something. And in cats sometimes can cause some nausea and salivation. So if we go through the different opioids, pure mu opioid are definitely the gold standard analgesic. You can give them IV, they work in minutes. Your analgesia has no ceiling effect, which means that you can start giving a lower dose if you are afraid that, again, your patient is too unstable, for example. And then you can always titrate the dose that you're giving to reach the desired analgesic effect. Is used to moderate and severe pain. And remember, for all pure mu opioid, their reversal is always possible by using naloxone, which it means that if you're giving it and you get two severe side effects, you can always reverse them by using naloxone. The reported side effects of pure mu opioid are always respiratory depression, that it's reported by everyone, like one of these side effects that you see every time, which actually it is really not true. Most of the time you might see respiratory depression if you give a higher, very high dose, but on the analgesic dose that we normally use, we barely see it. Sometimes can cause emesis and nausea, can cause a bit of sedation. Sometimes with higher dose, it can cause tachypnea and bradycardia. Morphine is being used by a lot of people for a long time, but I think the majority of people don't use morphine anymore. Morphine is a great analgesic. It can be given IV, IM subcutaneously. It can also be used on a constant rate infusion. Careful if you're giving it as a bolus intravenously, because rapid administration of morphine could cause vomiting and could also cause especially histamine release, which can then cause a cardiovascular collapse in your patient. Now, the reason why I think a lot of people stop using morphine is that morphine, actually, no matter which route you administer it, often cause vomiting, either that you give it IM subcutaneously or intramuscularly, both in cats and in dogs. So even if obviously the emesis is short, it's self-limiting, but obviously maybe something that you don't want in your patient. Now, methadone is definitely a great analgesic as a pure opioid, can again be given as a bolus, IV, IM, subcutaneously. And actually, I have to admit, methadone is the analgesic that I use in every patient that comes through the door. For me, it's the analgesic of choice in my experience, again, in emergency and critical care patients. Remember that it causes less vomiting than morphine does, actually almost never, but in dogs it might cause some tachypnea. So you would, once you give it after a few minutes, you would see a dog start panting quite a lot. In cats, we don't really see that. Buprenorphine, fentanyl, we said before, is pure opioid, or sulfentanil, remifentanil. They're great analgesia. They have a very rapid onset of action, and they also have a very short duration of action, which means that their use with boluses, it's not very handy, because it means that every 15 minutes you would have to give another small bolus to the patient, etc. So we mainly tend to use them as a constant rate infusion. So often my patient, they require moderate to severe pain, maybe in an emergency situation, and again when they come through the emergency room, I would use methadone because it's easy, it's handy, I don't need to have a pump in that moment. But as soon as they are then admitted to the intensive care, then obviously I would switch to fentanyl or sulfentanyl for better analgesic. For patients that goes home or for animals that are not very easy treatable or patients that start eating, they don't have an IV catheter anymore, remember that there is also a transdermal fentanyl patch that could be used. The dose that we should calculate is 2 to 3, again, microgram per kilo per hour. They have a bit, remember that they don't work immediately. To get a good analgesia, they require usually 12 to 24 hours in dogs and 8 to 12 hours in cats, but it gives a good analgesia for 3 to 4 days. Remember not to cut the fentanyl patch, but eventually if it's too big to cover part of it and not to cut it, to make again a smaller dosage, because fentanyl can leak and then it's not very, that doesn't work anymore. And this is actually the cat, obviously, that I showed in the beginning. As you can see, the cat that was a few days after hospitalization, this cat received a multimodal, in the beginning, a multimodal analgesia of sulfentanil, ketamine, and later on also non-steroidal. But this is when she was going to go home, and this replaced the sulfentanil patch. But you can see already how the posture of this cat incredibly changed from the cat that she was before to now. The cat, you could better without her killing you. Still, you couldn't. Well, she was not super happy, obviously, when you were going the abdomen, but the abdomen was so swollen and painful. But I would have never, ever be possible for me to do anything like this in the beginning. So again, that show you how really posture and everything changes as soon as the animal is well analgesed. And again, that show you that having a pain scoring to see the difference also lot of time, it really helps. Another partial agonist, say before, another opioid partial agonist is buprenorphine. And I have to say, at least where I work, not really in my intensive care, but veterinarians here in the Netherlands use a lot of buprenorphine also in emergency patients because they are confident in using buprenorphine. Buprenorphine has less side effect of methadone or morphine, for example. So I think the majority feels happier to use something that would give less side effects in an emergency patient than actually a pure opioid. But there are a few things about buprenorphine that we should know, and I think that makes buprenorphine not my favorite analgesic drug to use in an emergency patient. Now, first of all, let's say the buprenorphine works for mild to moderate pain. The problem with buprenorphine is that it has a slow onset of action, which means that when you give it, it will work after half an hour, 45 minutes, which again for me means if you have a dog like a Jenny or a cat like Elmo and you think it's painful and you want to give something to that patient, you want that to work fast. You don't want them to be in pain for 30, 45 minutes. And also it means that probably you are also unable to do a lot of diagnostics in those patients when they are so painful. Remember the buprenorphine being a partial agonist has a ceiling effect. So it means that you give the maximum dose and the animal is still painful. You could give another dose of buprenorphine, but that often doesn't actually cause an increase in the analgesic effect, because once buprenorphine binds to the receptor, then the analgesic effect of buprenorphine will not be increased. It doesn't have a lot of side effects, which is true. But another important point of buprenorphine that we have to remember is that because buprenorphine binds really, really tight to the mu receptor, if you have given buprenorphine to a patient and you feel that that patient is still painful, you cannot use in that patient a pure mu opioid. So let's say I've given to Elmo or to Jenny actually buprenorphine, and Jenny needs to go for whatever reason to surgery. Well, that because I gave him buprenorphine, for 6 hours I will be unable to use a pure mu opioid because the pure mu opioid will not be able to bind to the mu receptor. So again, think in advance if your emergency patient might require surgery where you probably want to use maybe pure mu opioid as part of your anesthetic regime, just be careful not to use buprenorphine. But buprenorphine, again, in the postoperative period or in patients that are a bit more stable, works very well, especially in cats. And in cats, you could also administer buprenorphine orally, not in dogs, but 20 micrograms per kilo oral, again, transmucosal administration in cats works very well as an analgesic. So something else to think about. Now, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, they are potent analgesic, they are antipyretic, and are anti-inflammatory. And obviously, I told you before that inflammation is one of the most common way of pain, again, in emergency critical care patients. Now, but they also have a slow onset of action. They last for quite long, which can be quite good things. But there is a big but when we talk about non-steroidal in emergency critical care patients. Actually, I would call it more than a but, a real concern. You probably will remember the way non-steroidal actually work. I don't see the slide at the moment. Yeah, here we go, if I can go back. Yeah, so non-steroidal in emergency patients are definitely, we should never use them. And I don't care if we use, again, the selective COX-2 or the COX-1, COX-2, actually, if you have a patient that comes through the door in shock, that suffer from renal problem, coagulopathic, but for me, shock, hypotension, hypoperfusion, it's already a reason not to use analgesia. Not to use non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, analgesia. And this is a little bit a reminder of how actually they work, meaning that non-steroidal, we know that they block your COX oxygenase, the one we always say is constitutive. Day two actually is the one is induced by inflammation. The way actually what happens is that normally if they block your cyclooxygenase also, we will have a decreased production in mainly prostaglandin and thromboxan. And thromboxan, we know it's a very potent platelet activator, which means that non-steroidal administration might also decrease the ability of that patient to clot. So it should also never be used in patients that have already coagulation problem. But the most scary or the most severe side effects is actually decreased production in prostaglandin. Decreased production in prostaglandin in a patient that is in shock, is hypoperfused, could cause two major side effects. One, gastrointestinal ulceration, and second, again, ischemic acute kidney injury. So these are, for me, a big reason enough not to give at all to a patient that comes, again, as an emergency patient or is in your intensive care on your recovery, that is not cardiovascularly stable, that is in shock, that is hypotensive, not to use non-steroidal. So non-steroidal, again, should be avoided in patients in shock, severely dehydrated, with hemostatic disorder that are already obviously receiving corticosteroids, which have acute or chronic renal failure or with severe gastrointestinal disease. But as I say, non-steroidal drugs are good analgesics, so they could be considered only once your patient is stable, but also with no further potential for deterioration, which means that it's not the animal that comes as an emergency, is in shock, you give him a few boluses of fluid, is stable, and I can use my non-steroidal. That patient often, I mean, you probably have seen it, some of these patients might deteriorate in the coming hours. So I really, really need to be sure that my patient is cardiovascularly stable, there is no problem whatsoever before I give an non-steroidal. There are different drugs that can be used. Carprofen is licensed in dogs for acute and chronic use, and meaning cats only for one-time perioperative use. While Metacam is being licensed in dogs and cats, at least where I work, for chronic pain, and cats also for acute pain, and I reported the dose that I usually suggested both in dogs and again in cats. And as I said, again, they can definitely be considered and they can definitely be used once your patient is actually stable. Ketamine, you probably know it as an analgesic, is an N-methyl-D aspartate receptor antagonist, as can be used again as a dissociative anesthetic. But when you use it on a very, very low dose, especially in a constant rate infusion, it can work in your multimodal analgesic protocol. Has minimal cardiovascular depression, they cause minimal ventilatory depression, so again, could definitely be a very good adjunct to your multimodal analgesia protocol. This is the dose that normally we use, a small, again, loading bolus of 0.3, 0.5 milligram per kilo, usually followed by 2 to 5 microgram per kilo per minute on a constant rate infusion, both in dogs and in cats. With this dosage, ketamine alone is not a very strong analgesic, but again, when added to a multimodal analgesic protocol, usually to an opioid, then it will increase the analgesic effect. At this dosage, also, people are still worried that it will cause dysphoria. I have to admit, I rarely see it, and if I see it, I decrease the dose, and often the dysphoria might disappear. So minimal dysphoric effect. There are a few things that I would just be careful in animals that have an increased intracranial pressure. So again, animal with severe brain injury and traumatic brain injury. Animal with history of seizure, even if there are some debate on it. Severe liver and kidney disease, I would be careful. More because we know that ketamine is metabolized, meaning the liver excreted by the kidney. So by severe liver or kidney disease, the both metabolization and excretion of ketamine might be, again, delayed. Other drugs that we can use on a multimodal, they are the alpha-2 agonist, and you all know medetomidine and dexmedetomidine. The alpha-2 agonists, they've shown to have a synergic and additive effect with opioids, and they can also be used as anti-anxiety and sedative effects because they do have an additive, say, sedative and anxiolytic effect in our patient. But we know that both alpha-2 agonists, even if used at very low dose, like in an analgesia, and not just as an anesthetic, let's say, drug, they still have some cardiovascular effect, like bradycardia, mild hypertension, on and off, followed by hypotension. So again, they should only be considered in patients, again, that are cardiovascularly stable, and maybe not in the patient that is, again, in shock, or that is not cardiovascularly stable. We can use a bolus of induction. I have to admit, in the past years, I've not been using the bolus so much, I have to admit. I usually start my constant rate infusion and I see very rapidly an effect. And constant rate infusion, you can titrate it. I put 1 microgram per kilo per hour, but you can start with 0.5 microgram, or you can, for example, increase it to 1, 1.5, 2, depending on the effect that you want to reach. Other drugs that can be used, lidocaine, they are reported the dose 50 to 70 microgram per kilo per minute. As we know that we use it, actually, it can be a local analgesic, can be used in antiarrhythmic effect in ventricular tachycardia most of the time. And again, alone, yes, when give it intravenously as a constant rate infusion, it only has a mild analgesic effect. So can be used and its place can be present again in a multi-analgesia protocol. Careful, and that's what I wrote, in cats should never be used because cats tend to accumulate, again, lidocaine, and lidocaine has severe toxic effect in cats. It causes some central nervous system severe side effects like seizure, so again, should never be used. Bupivacaine, chirocaine could also be used, again, usually diluted as a pleural block or through, for example, a thoracic drain after a thoracic surgery as a sort of a local block or local analgesia. Those drugs could also be used as a splash block in an animal with severe abdominal pain. Could also be administered via sort of abdominal syntesis, not syntesis, but via, again, the abdomen to ideally work locally, for example, in case of pancreatitis, in case of severe localized abdominal pain, to decrease, again, analgesia. Obviously, we cannot repeat it every 3 to 4 hours for the risk of maybe contamination of the abdominal cavity. So remember also when you do an abdominal injection of analgesia, you have always to do it in the most sterile way as possible. So again, with, as I said before, multimodal analgesia is a bit the way to go. The opioid should be your base, and then based on, again, how painful your patient is and what is his clinical condition, you could add different drugs to, you can again add different drugs to see how that works. So opioketamine, opioid alpha 2 drugs and ketamine, etc., etc. I'm sure that some of you have heard, and I put here a sort of a recipe, even if I will explain I'm not personally a big fan of it, but some of you probably have heard of the classic milk or MLK, which is an infusion that is made by adding in the same bag of a isotonic crystalloid infusion most of the time, morphine, ketamine, and lidocaine together. And as you can see, this is one of the different recipes that are available. There is an amount that you have to add to, again, a bag of fluid, and it gives you also the rate that you have to run it with. It works well. Obviously, it's a way of giving a multimodal analgesia protocol, especially when you are in a private practice and maybe you don't have 3 different pumps where you can actually, again, run separately 3 different analgesics. So that I understand very well. The problem that I might have with the MLK or the milk is that obviously if you see any side effects in that patient, you don't know if it is the lidocaine, the ketamine, or the morphine. And you are unable to decrease one of these components, and the only way that you could do is eventually throw away the bag and make a new one with decreasing one of these 3 drugs. So it is less, it's more difficult to titrate it to the patient, but as I say, it works very well, especially if you don't have access to a lot of different syringe pumps. Because maybe I was not clear, the way that I do multimodal analgesia by running through the same IV line, obviously different syringes with different analgesia separately, so that I can, in that patient, increase or decrease, depending on what I want to achieve, the different analgesics singularly. So what did we did in Jenny? So when Jenny arrived, obviously she was cardiovascular unstable, so I didn't know what was going to happen with Jenny, so I administered her initially a low dose of methadone, 0.1 milligram per kilo of methadone IV. I diluted it usually and I gave it over 5 minutes, not to give it very quickly. And when she was a bit more stable, meaning when my fluid therapy was on the way and I drained the pneumothorax, I gave her a second dose of methadone. Afterwards, obviously, Jenny required further stabilization in the intensive care, and that femoral fracture was very painful. So then I switched her to a fentanyl constant rate infusion followed by ketamine, also constant rate infusion. What did we did with Elmo? With Elmo was a bit the same. I started with 0.1 milligram per kilo methadone IV, and that was enough in that patient actually to give some, obviously, and a bit of sedation, a bit of analgesia. And as soon as I disobstructed, obviously, the urethra, I kept him also as part of my sort of a slight anesthesia protocol. I also put him on fentanyl CRI. And this was Elmo afterwards. Obviously, the bladder was not so distended anymore, and that definitely helped, but also this meant that you can see that I could touch his abdomen. He was rolling in a bag. He loved this box. So this, for me, is a cat that is much, much more comfortable. So to conclude again this talk, please don't forget to evaluate pain as your fifth vital sign. Obviously, it's fundamental to know pulse, respiration, temperature, mental state, do the analgesia scoring as well. Use the pain scoring systematically. Initially, as I say, if you're not used to it, you probably have to have your little paper close to you so to remember yourself what you need to score. But really, believe me, after a while it becomes so automatic that you really don't need to use the paper with you anymore. And don't use, again, a fixed analgesia protocol for every patient, but tailor the analgesic regime for your patient, because every patient would really, really react differently. So this for what, the pharmacological approach, but also remember to try to reduce anxiety stress. So considering a very agitated patient, maybe low dose if the patient is stable alpha-2 agonist, and your TLC are also fundamental as part, again, of your analgesia. And with this, I wanted again to conclude the presentation. I see here that there are some questions, so I will definitely try to answer them. Let me see, if I can see well. Okay, one question is there any point in giving buprenorphine for additional pain relief after medetomidine and butorphanol pre-med? This is a very good question. Probably I would say yes, because butorphanol works a bit different than buprenorphine, and it depends also on the dose of butorphanol that you have used. And butorphanol, as I say, analgesia lasts for very, very short. Most of the time you say that the sedation lasts for 4 hours, while the analgesic effect lasts for, we say 1 to 2 hours, while buprenorphine would last for 6 hours. So obviously a lot depends on which dose you've given it, but most of the time buprenorphine and butorphanol, they work both. Actually, buprenorphine can be given after butorphanol. Definitely, there is absolutely no problem. There is another question that I see. I've heard conflict opinions of to what degree buprenorphine blocks full mu agonist. Some people believe that there is still benefit given methadone if they've had buprenorphine recently. What is the evidence? This is another very good question, which I'm afraid I don't know if I will really be able to answer properly, meaning that I've heard that as well. I have to admit that the people that I've been working with and everything that I've been reading about buprenorphine and about, again, the way it works, it really confirms that buprenorphine really binds to the mu receptor. Now, what some people often says, which again means that it blocks the mu receptor, for which, again, and for example, giving extra buprenorphine doesn't really work, but also giving methadone or morphine, etc., will not work. Now, what some people sometimes say is that if you, for example, give it on a higher dose, some of that methadone might work, but it is very complicated, meaning that there is really no right or wrong, and there is not much evidence that starting in an animal that just received buprenorphine, a pure mu opioid, will actually work. You might see the side effects of the pure mu opioid, which are often not related to the mu, again, receptor, but you might not have the beneficial effect of the analgesia. So if I have given buprenorphine to a patient, unfortunately, I cannot antagonize it, so I'm a bit stuck with it, but maybe I will not wait 6 hours. Already after 4 hours, I will start again with my pure mu opioid. And if in that 4 hours my patient is painful, what I would then rather do is actually use the multimodal protocol, meaning then combine, if possible, for example, ketamine SRI, lidocaine SRI, and wait until my buprenorphine is out of the system and then add in that moment a pure mu opioid. I think these were the questions that I had. So I would like to thank you again, thank everyone for listening and also CPD Solution for inviting me. Thanks.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Chiara for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.